You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Christian Book. Christian, thanks so much for being with me today.
It's a great pleasure. Thank you for having me on your show.
So, Christian, tell me a little bit about where you are. You're in Australia right now, Northern Australia. Is that correct?
Yes, I'm currently living in Darwin, Australia. I moved to Australia about 2 years ago to take up a position at Charles Darwin University, where I'm founding a creative writing program. It's a beautiful tropical paradise, somewhat remote, closer to Indonesia than I'm probably to the capital cities here in Australia, but it's a wonderful experience. Beautiful ocean vistas, lovely people, fantastic place to be a poet.
Well, that sounds beautiful. So I want to talk about your work, but also tell me a little bit about the program you're founding there. It sounds like you're responsible for shaping a writing program there.
Yes, Charles Darwin University is a small university here in Australia. It does not have a creative writing program, and I was a leading member of a team of people at the University of Calgary running a creative writing program there. And I thought this would be a pretty interesting opportunity for me to do something that I could make in my own image. So I took up this position with an eye towards constructing a centerpiece creative writing program that would be an important linchpin of the Department of Creative Arts here at the university.
And how is it different in terms of what you're doing as a poet and a teacher? Can we talk about that for a minute? Just how you shape the program so it is different, because it is so I would imagine that all departments are a little bit different. How writing and poetry is taught. How is your approach different from the traditional approach, if it is?
Well, I'm an experimental poet, so my aesthetic sensibilities are thoroughly informed by a history of avant-garde literary practice. I, of course, hope to bring that kind of sensibility to my pedagogy here at Charles Darwin University. But, of course, I'm serving students who have their own aspirations. They might hope to become a great fiction writer, a great poet, writing perhaps an ordinary literary narrative or lyrical forms of verse, and I think it's my job to make it possible for those students to do that well. So it's a relatively diverse aesthetic program I have here. My courses are designed to satisfy a variety of needs and interests, so I'm hoping, in effect, to build something that would be attractive to people from a wide variety of aesthetic sensibilities.
And what else are you working on now? You're editing and also writing. What other aspects of writing or otherwise are you working?
My current project right now involves me making artworks for an art show that's forthcoming in September. I promised that I would make a submission to a group show whose theme was based on the office or the hardware store. We were constrained to use materials that we could find at office supply stores or hardware stores. And in my case, I'm building a series of paintings that are informed by a really strange painting by Kazimir Majevich from 1918. It was a limit case in the history of painting in which he painted two white squares, one superimposed slightly askew upon the other. And the poem this painting is called White on White. I've produced 16 variations of this painting that are constructed from permutations of paint chips that you find at a hardware store, producing maquettes out of those paint chips, and then painting facsimiles of the original painting from these kinds of white colors. And
before you go on, I'm not completely clear about that. I know
sure.
The painting that you're referencing, the mm-hmm. supremacist painting that he was doing, right?
That's right.
How are you using the paint chips from the hardware store? You're assembling them, or you're using the paint?
Sure.
How does that?
I'm making a collage out of say two versions of white, two paint chips that are white. And cut a perfect facsimile, a maquette of the original painting, White on White, and it just so happens that that maquette becomes a tiny little haiku poem that is built around the names of the white colors that are superimposed upon each other. So if I take a white that's called Gentle Wind and I superimpose it upon a white that's called Tokyo Snow, I produce a little haiku poem. And that maquette is a little poetic object. And then what I do is paint a facsimile of the original White on White by Kazimir Majevich that incorporates those two colors, those two versions of white. And I've got 16 variations of them, all of which collectively produce a large-scale poem that has been translated into these colors.
And the pieces themselves, so these are visual art, of course, and as well as a kind of concrete poem, right? And are they very small?
The maquettes, the little paint chips, are small. They're about the scale of a filing card, a little collage that's built out of the two colors superimposed upon each other to produce a little model of the original painting. It's a perfect facsimile of the original painting. But the actual visual art is done on a canvas to scale with the colors that are identified in the paint chips, and it produces a copy, I guess, of Kazimir Majevich's painting. It's just that it's now two different shades or hues of white than the ones that he used in his suprematist painting.
And I love that. So that's interesting. So that kind of introduces also the listeners to your poetry and visual work. And when will that show go up? When will that happen?
That'll go up in September. There'll be a third component to it. Each one of the paint chips gets translated into a series of kanji to produce a little haiku poem that's actually done in Japanese calligraphy, and that will accompany the artworks. So it's really a work of visual poetry that incorporates paintings as part of its poetic practice. And it'll be up sometime in mid-September for this group show. I'm looking forward to it. It's a fun project, something relatively straightforward to do, and it's conceptually rich, you know, for a poet to practice something like this.
It is, and so those are two things you're working on. Are there other editing projects before we get to the writing that you're working on?
Sure, I've just finished editing a book with my friend Gregory Betts called Avant Canada. It's a collection of essays and poetic contributions by experimental Canadian writers that responds to the last 50 years of Canadian literary history, discussing the influence of avant-garde practice upon Canadian literature. So just a collection of academic and scholarly work about the last 50 years of experimental literature in the Canadian context. That book should be forthcoming, I think, sometime in December. We're in the process right now of putting the finishing touches on it for publication. We're producing the index and getting the work typeset. It's in the last phases of its production right now.
Well, that's exciting. And is there anything else you're working on that we should talk about before I ask you about your own writing?
Oh, well, I'm always working on a long-term project that has been ongoing since 2002 called the Xenotext. This is a very ambitious project that I've almost been working upon exclusively.
Tell me more about the Xenotext experiment and how it began so we can understand more about that.
Sure. For the last, it's almost 17 years since 2002, I've been working on a long-term project, somewhat ambitious. We've been working on this project almost exclusively that requires me to write a very short poem, and then through a process of encipherment, I translate it into a genetic sequence. And then with the assistance of a laboratory, we actually build that poem in the lab and implant it into the genome of a bacterium, replacing part of its genetic code with my text. So the organism now becomes the living embodiment of my poem. Now, lots of scientists and artists have actually enciphered information into microbes like this, but my poem is different in so far as it actually causes the organism to build a protein in response. The organism writes a poem that is enciphered into this protein molecule. So in effect, I've engineered a bacterium so that it becomes not only an archive for storing my poem, it becomes a machine for writing a poem in response. And the punchline to this project is that the selected organism for this host is in fact an unkillable bacterium called Deinococcus radiodurans. It's capable of surviving in all kinds of hostile environments. You can freeze it, wither it, scorch it, and it continues to endure. It can even survive in the open vacuum of outer space, and it can withstand 1,000 times the dosage of gamma radiation that might instantly obliterate a human being. It's widely regarded as one of the most unkillable things ever to have evolved on the planet. And by putting my poem into this bacterium, I could conceivably be creating a book that might persist forever, might outlast terrestrial civilization, and it might be on the planet Earth when the sun explodes. I'm really trying to produce a poem that could persist effectively forever. That's my project. And I'm still in the process of getting it to work properly. I've managed to get the project to work successfully in another kind of bacterium, in a colony of E. coli, as a proof of concept. But I'm still trying to get it to work properly in the host organism, the target organism. Still a long-term goal. And in the meantime, I've published material from that project. It's just a continuing kind of lifetime effort, I think. It's proving to be much more challenging than I ever anticipated. And so far, though, I've made a lot of progress.
Well, that's fascinating. And, of course, you know, we were talking about biological engineering. And when you said it produces a protein response, so in a sense you've created an indestructible, you know, biological machine that writes poetry, right? A poet.
That's right. Sure. I mean, sure. When people, among my critics, when my critics say that poetry is dead, you know, my response, of course, is to build an unkillable poem. I think that's you know, the adequate response like to critics who complain about the death of poetry.
So I like that. So how do you extract the poem? And can you talk about some of what is written by the bacterium when it produces this protein?
Sure.
I imagine somehow then you're able to extract that and read what that protein is writing, essentially, right?
When the poem that I've written begins, a little short sonnet, the opening line is, "Any style of life is prim." And the organism might begin to read that text, and in response, it writes, "The fairy is rosy of glow," in ciphering these lines of poetry in a protein. And it just so happens that when it writes that line, "The fairy is rosy of glow," the protein that it creates causes the organism to actually fluoresce red. It becomes rosy, just like the fairy that it describes. And so you can actually see the effect of this upon the organism. You know that it's making the poem because it causes the organism to fluoresce red. You can detect the protein within the organism through a series of chemical processes, and it would be possible, at least conceptually, to derive that protein and analyze its molecular structure. And if you have the key to that molecular cipher, you'd be able to then decode the poem and read it from that protein sequence. The important thing for me is just that it signals that there's something interesting in the organism by fluorescing like this. You know, it's not so much that you need the key to be able to read the poem. It's more like spray painting graffiti on an obelisk. Millions of years in the future, that graffiti might appear to be illegible, but its presence testifies to intelligent design.
So that's fascinating. So when it glows, was that something you intended? Did you also engineer that glow, or did that just happen to happen? And did it happen?
No.
Of course, doesn't actually. Or is it kind of random, or what is it? Nothing's random.
No. I've intentionally designed the poem and the protein so that they generate these effects. It's a part of the exercise to produce something that does this performative gesture. It glows red because the poem talks about itself glowing red, and that aspect of that feature of the protein has actually been engineered from the start.
Okay, so that's fascinating to explain and understand. I mean, understanding what you just said, you're obviously able to see this and extract this and show the evidence for this. But typically, how would someone else, let's say in the future, look at some of this bacterium and extract a poem and recognize that it was also performing the poem?
Well, I think that the first cue is the fact that you would have this protein that causes the organism to fluoresce, and it's not a native component of the organism. There's all kinds of cues around the genetic sequence that indicates that this is an artificial construct. It's simply pointing to itself at numerous places within the genetic sequence to suggest that it's in fact artificial. It's been inserted, and that's sufficient. I mean, I don't imagine that, you know, a million years from now there will be English speakers capable of decoding a cipher from a protein sequence. But I mean, if they had access to the key and they were capable of understanding English, they should be able to characterize the actual protein and detect the message buried within it. I mean, it could be that, of course, there are, in fact, messages enciphered into the genetic structure of organisms, even in our own ecology. It could be that there are messages from outer space already embedded somewhere in the genome of a virus or a spore or some microorganism, and we just don't notice it yet because we aren't smart enough cryptographers with fast enough computers to analyze the genetic sequences and extract messages that might in fact be already embedded within them. I mean, it would make a very interesting means of communication across extraterrestrial distances over galactic time to actually encipher messages in a virus and just allow them to propagate on their own throughout the cosmos. Lots of scientists have speculated with this extravagant hypothesis, imagining that this might be a means by which communication could occur between civilizations across epochal time. I know it's a strange idea. It's a science fiction
idea.
Premise.
So how is it that you build this? In what lab? Is that at the university where you're working at, or is that in a special lab?
I've worked with several laboratories. I've worked with several laboratories. Initially with laboratories at the University of Calgary, laboratories at the University of Wyoming. I've also used commercial providers in Silicon Valley. I've worked with a variety of corporations and laboratories over the course of the years trying to get this project to work. You know, these collaborations are dependent upon access to resources and expertise, so that's why I've, you know, had to work with a variety of partners to make this happen. I have to, you know, design the structure genetically, and I have to design the proteomic sequence for the proteins. I have to do all of that myself, but the laboratories will build things for me and test things for me, but they won't solve my problems. They won't do the research necessary for me to get the construct to work properly. They can give me some hypotheses if it fails, but it's up to me to be able to do all of the genetic engineering and proteomic engineering myself.
Well,
and so I've acquired
to them is that you're also, you know, adding to the discourse of bioengineering as other artists are in different ways, but you're adding to it.
Sure.
In your own peculiar way through the process you've outlined. Right?
Sure. I mean, I've you know, had very interesting conversations with my scientific collaborators, and they're interested in the project enough to want to assist me. Obviously, I don't think that I'm making, you know, an innovative contribution to the history of genetic engineering, but as an artist, I'm certainly making it possible for other artists to have permission to experiment with these kinds of technologies. I'm trying to be a poet in the 21st century, responding to the, you know, technological circumstances of my moment in time. A lot of poets, I think, are hesitant to broach subjects in the sciences. It's not a topic frequently for poetic investigation, and consequently, it's an area of exploration that I get to investigate almost exclusively. There's not many other writers who are interested in these same kinds of questions and activities.
And that's very exciting. I'm glad we talked about that. So now moving on to your poetry that you're writing. What is it that you're working on now? I know you're going to read something from previous, but is there something else that you're working on right now?
I'm always working on the xenotext. I'm writing poetry that provides support for these two little poems that would be genetically engineered into a bacterium. I have currently a book of poetry entitled The Xenotext, Book One. It is a pastoral introduction to the project, offering a kind of primer in genetic engineering, giving some of the aesthetic background of the project, and showcasing some poetry that's inspired by the whole activity. I've been working on poetry that pertains to the Xenotext in a kind of peripheral way, generating work that I hope will eventually be published in the subsequent volume if the project works out. If I manage to meet with success, then I can release the second volume, which showcases the outcome of the experiment. Now, if you'd like, I can perform for you a very short poem that appears in the Xenotext, Book 1. It's a sonnet written according to a whole variety of very Herculean procedural constraints. It won't sound like it took me 5 months to write it, but in fact, it took me 5 solid months with me working exclusively on nothing else. I just worked on this. It's an acrostic poem.
Let me ask you a little bit about that before you read it, and sure. Sorry to interrupt you, but go on. So when it took you 5 months to write it, you're talking about 5 months to biologically engineer it. Were you
no.
able to no.
No, this is a different poem from the Xenotext. It's a poem that appears in a book about the Xenotext. It's a sonnet written in blank verse as an Alexandrine sonnet. It has 12 syllables per line. It has a double acrostic structure so that the initial letters and the terminal letters in the poem spell out a little message. And every single line has exactly the same number of letters. And the reason that this poem took so long to write, of course, is that, yes, it's written according to these constraints, many of which are pretty manageable. But the entire poem itself is actually an anagram of a very famous sonnet by John Keats called When I Have Fears That I May Cease to Be. I've just taken his poem and rearranged the letters within it to conform to this new structure that speaks back to the precedent set by his work. So it's very complicated.
I understand, but it took so long in part because of that kind of double acrostic structure and so many other elements that you constrained yourself to. Is that correct?
That's exactly right. The work was difficult to produce in part because it's written according to all of these constraints. A wide variety of rules have been imposed upon my creative process here in an effort to generate something surprising, you know,
so
make the project difficult enough for me to...
Let's talk about that, but before jumping into the poem, so creating all these rules, as you're saying, to generate something surprising, I mean, just to speak to that for a minute, it sounds almost like the more rules you have, it's that much more of a kind of a muse for the artist, the poet. Is that correct? I mean, it's kind of interesting, just this notion of so many constraints, as you're saying, you know, kind of ridiculous amount of restraints, yet at the same time it produces surprise and ideally something a little magical, I would imagine.
Sure. I mean, I'm not the kind of poet who writes about his personal experience. I'm a poet who's more interested in being investigative and experimental. I believe poetry is not so much expressive as it is generative. The job of a poem is to figure out what you might hope to say, and in doing so, say something even better. I'm of course trying to surprise myself by making a discovery to showcase something about the potential of language that has so far gone unnoticed because nobody's gone looking for it. That's the kind of work that I typically do. I'm probably best known for doing the impossible thing. I do projects that are difficult and strange, and I'm doing them because I'm curious about what might happen if I try my hand at this particular task. I'm not motivated, I think, by having something personal that I want to communicate to the world, but I'm doing something that is more akin to a laboratory experiment. I'm really trying to find what language can do when it's freed from certain necessities to mean things. You know, when you can use language for purposes for which it was not intended, I guess.
So let's hear your poem.
Sure.
Getting towards the end, we'll talk a little bit afterwards, but I'd love to hear about what you're reading, and then I'd love to hear you read it.
Okay. Sure. The poem is called "The Nocturne of Orpheus," and it has a dedication for the maiden in her dark, pale meadow. The Nocturne of Orpheus. This covenant of love in a dirge for a god has delighted an angel who obeys my plea. Each sonnet a rhythm for her to decipher making legible a key in her dream of dusk. A redness that darkens the hue of a tulip is richening her view on the hill of a lea, dappling her vista at the end of my vigil, even if havoc calls forth ruin to kill me. No church, no chapel is a refuge in a storm if we beg to be warm, yet let die the candle. No herder, no hermit, enchanted by the sea, has hitherto known the ennui of a coward, even when infernos in hell burn the hero. Radiant as flint be the ache of my sorrow.
Thank you, Christian. In now that's there's also two acrostics in that poem, correct?
That's right.
Can you tell me what the acrostics are?
Sure. The acrostics are, in fact, the dedication for the maiden in her dark, pale meadow. If you were to read these acrostic messages, it would simply say, "The maiden in her dark, pale meadow." It, of course, enciphers the cryptic name of the person for whom the poem is intended.
How does it encipher the cryptic name for the poem was intended? That's within the phrase that you just mentioned?
That's correct. It's an in-joke, I suppose, for the person for whom it's intended. It's a translation of the dedicatee's name.
I love that. Thank you so much. And that's from a book that's already out. Is that correct?
That's correct. That's from the Xenotext, Book 1, available from Coach House Books, published in 2015.
Great. There'll be a link to that in here as well. And before I ask you the last question, is there anything else that I should have asked or you want to mention before I ask you the last question, which is, what you're reading? I'm just curious if I should have asked anything else or you want to mention something before we go.
No, I think you've certainly covered all of the material I'm currently invested in discussing. I think you've been pretty gracious to participate and have me contribute to the interview. Thanks a lot.
You're welcome. I'd love to know what you're reading at the moment. What is it that you're currently reading?
Well, what am I currently reading? I've been, I think, reading just a lot of popular science fiction. To tell you the truth, I have been reading works like Ready Player One. I've just finished reading some poetry in the form of manuscripts by friends, all of which is infused with science fiction imagery. I've probably been just conscientious about reading work that pertains to my own interest in the sciences these days. I've finished, reading the work called The Art of Charlie Chan Hok Chai by Sunny Liu. That was the last major work that I've read, a graphic novel about the history of Singapore, a work that I'm, in fact, teaching at Charles Darwin University. It's been an eclectic mix of books over the last few weeks, but I would suggest that I've been reading primarily for recreational entertainment.
Christian, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. It's really been a pleasure hearing about your work.
It's been a great pleasure to be able to participate on the show. Thanks a lot.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.